It will be the first bill up since Senator Kate Brown is here. Senate Bill 1104. We will go into public hearing on Senate Bill 1104, and I will ask counsel to summarize the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill has to do with, at least tangentially, is halfway houses or work release centers in the community. In the current law, what happens is when a halfway house or work release center is possibly proposed in a certain community, the Department of Corrections and a county or city is required to designate a citizens advisory committee to look at that, look at the location, and some other details regarding that. As I understand it, under current law, this does not apply to similar youth care facilities or other facilities authorized to accept youth offenders. What this bill would do is require the Oregon Youth Authority and the State Office for Services to Children and Families to appoint a citizens advisory committee in an area that either proposes to establish a youth care facility or another similar facility.
Good morning, Senator. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back in the House where they actually start committee hearings on time. I'm, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7, and I very much appreciate being here before you this morning, especially since the sun is shining. And I also appreciate the Chair giving this bill a hearing. I introduced this bill at the request of one of my Southeast Portland Neighborhood Associations, Buckman Neighborhood, and Andy Eisman, who's with the Neighborhood Association, I think has been with it for several years, wasn't able to be here this morning because he's homesick and bad. But basically, what is happening in Portland, and may be happening around the rest of the state, is that we are having residential facilities that house adjudicated youth placed in our residential neighborhoods. And that is fine, except that the facilities tend to be located in those neighborhoods where the properties are the least expensive. And in Portland, that primarily happens to be the east side of Portland. So we are, first of all, very concerned about the large numbers of correctional facilities being located in residential neighborhoods. That issue is not addressed by this bill. What this bill focuses on is making sure that there's citizen involvement when the facilities are going to be placed in the neighborhoods. There are several ways to look at this issue. This is just simply one way, and we chose this particular way. I think Senator Bryant chose this particular way to move forward because, A, it was already current law, and what we're doing is simply adding the Oregon Youth Authority into a system that the Department of Corrections already complies with. And the other reason is, for the most part, there's no opposition to this bill. When you start getting involved in this issue, and I have been simply because of what's been happening in Portland, you will learn that it's pretty complicated. It involves the city, involves the county, involves the state, and it also involves the federal government and the Federal Fair Housing Act, and then we also have private providers that are involved. To the best of my ability and my knowledge, there's no one of those groups that oppose that, and the neighborhood associations are in support of this. Just for your information, there are two other bills that were introduced by me on this issue, and I believe another bill that's out there. Senate Bill 936 requires all the agencies involved with the siting of these particular facilities to basically talk to each other. We thought it would be a brilliant idea that...
Well, duh. But.
Right, exactly. That bill is still sitting in Senate Judiciary because we couldn't figure out how to make the well duh bill work at very minimal cost, et cetera. So that's still sitting in Senate Judiciary. The other bill is Senate Bill 1308, which Senator Wilde has another bill out there, Senate Bill 1040, that deals with notification and specific community notification and some other requirements.
Senator,
have I talked too much?
Do you want to talk?
I'll be quiet.
We have four votes here now.
Okay.
We have an amendment, the -1 amendment, which I understand the Oregon Youth Authority would like to see because they don't want to have to retrospectively go back and try to identify communities and create these advisory committees there. But certainly they're willing to do so from now on. And I understand you're comfortable with that.
Very comfortable. We just didn't get it to the Senate Judiciary Committee in time.
Mr. Hill's note to me is that he couldn't be here tonight. Karen Brazeau is ill, and that this is, I'm stating this for the record, that OIA, with this -1 amendment, would not object to the bill. In fact, it appears that they would support the bill. So we have no one else signed up, no one in opposition. I will tell you, in the past, I've dealt with these issues in regard to the Santa community, and you're right. Sometimes you open Pandora's box, and you have to be real careful about how you approach it. So I commend you for finding an approach here that's copacetic. And with that, I'll move us into work session on Senate Bill 1104 and ask if Representative Sinceri moves the Dash 1 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sinceri moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1104. Is there any discussion on those amendments? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Sinceri, do you have a motion on the bill?
Move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
College?
I think we should write this down someplace, though, Mr. Chair. Somewhere. Just so we have record that we did this.
We'll just write down, Senator Brown, you owe us. I'm just kidding.
Well, I didn't want to actually say it like that.
Mr. Chair, not only do you start on time, but you act quickly.
That's
very
my
exciting
colleagues
in this process.
Read these bills ahead of time, and they're ready for action. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. Senate Bill 1104 with the Dash 1 amendments. The sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Sinceri, would you be the carrier on this?
Yes, I thought I heard Representative Bowman say
that. Representative Bowman, would you like to be the carrier? Representative Bowman will be the carrier. This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 1104. Thank you very much. What's up next, Councilor? Oh, let's do 443.
Yeah.
We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 443. We have conflict amendments. Councilor, please tell us about those.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was passed out of the committee 2 days ago, and immediately after the hearing, I was informed by legislative counsel that the A4 amendments are necessary in order to resolve some conflicts. And
this is with other legislation.
It appears to be with House Bill 2168, which came through this committee as well, and they don't change any of the substance of 443A.
All right. While we have four people in the room, I understand we would need a reconsideration motion, and then we adopt a conflict amendment.
Correct.
Representative Hansen, do you move reconsideration of Senate Bill 443 for the purpose of adopting conflict amendments?
Certainly.
Representative Hansen so moves. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. Senate Bill 443 is in front of us. Representative Hansen, do you move adoption of the A4 amendments, which are conflict amendments with other legislation?
Okay.
Have they been filed in the committee?
They were.
They just were distributed this morning.
And this simply makes our bill fit with other legislation which has already passed.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question, though, about the A4.
Sure. Do you have a motion on it?
Yes. I move the Dash A4 amendments into Senate Bill 443.
Very well. The motion is stated. Representative Bowman, your question?
My question has to do with the change for or dependency on line 12 in the A4. That's not something that we talked about, dependency on vapor-releasing substances.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, we did not talk about that in context of Senate Bill 443. I think that when House Bill 2168, which this resolves conflicts with, was before us, we did talk about dependency on alcohol or other controlled substances in the context of driving under the influence of one of those. And I am not clear as to whether or not 2168 has been signed by the governor, but I think it may have been. And in that case, what needs to happen is simply to make this in line and copacetic with that bill, we would need to add dependency on vapor-releasing substances as well. Although, actually, as I look at this...
The idea is a screening interview would also cover that topic when they're looking at drugs or alcohol. Because vapor-releasing substances are now covered by the same law, they should deal with all of it at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, actually, if I look at this, we changed this to inhalants, not vapor-releasing substances. So there is a problem with these. I think we need to bring this back.
Oh, great.
I'm sorry.
That we do.
Well, then, would you like to withdraw your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Unless we do a conceptual amendment to replace vapor-releasing substances with inhalants.
All right. If there is no objection to suspension of the rules for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment, we could change it to
vapor-releasing.
The inhalants language.
Uh-huh.
All right. I'd entertain a motion. First of all, I'd ask, is there any objection to suspension of the rules for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment?
Do I not give her withdrawal then?
Now we are... Representative Bowman moves suspension of the rules for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment. There's no objection noted, so the motion is carried. The rules are suspended. A conceptual amendment is in order. Representative Bowman, are you willing to move that we use the language that we finally adopted, which has to do with inhalants rather than vapor-releasing substances, in the context of these A4 amendments on lines 12 and 13?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I make the motion that we adopt the A4 as conceptually amended on line 12 to read dependency on inhalant substances.
Dependency on inhalants.
On inhalants.
Very well. The motion's been stated. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. And the A4 amendments with the conceptual amendment are now added to the bill. President Bowman, do you move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
And for the record, this also includes, we understand, the A3s previously adopted, that they've not been stripped out. So we have the A3 amendments previously adopted and these A4 amendments with the conceptual amendment. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion carries. And the bill is sent back to the floor with a due pass with these amendments. Who is our carrier?
Representative Prozanski, what's the carrier on this?
We'll surprise him with these changes and have Representative Prozanski still be the carrier. That concludes the work session on Senate Bill 443. And thank you, Representative Cesari, for the coffee.
Absolutely.
Here to serve. Great. We've moved that one out again. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 443. Next, we have Senate Bill 1210 up for public hearing. So we're going to public hearing on Senate Bill 1210. Looks like we're ready for some testimony. Come on down.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. Obviously, this is the first time I've been privileged to be in here, but I get the sense you like to move through things really quickly, so I'll provide the abbreviated explanation this morning.
Let me put it this way. Senate Judiciary has a backlog of about 60 bills from us.
That probably is ample evidence. The Senate Bill 1210 comes to you following unanimous vote in the Senate. Its objective is clearly stated, and that is to facilitate cooperation between law enforcement entities and insurers as it relates to the investigation of criminal conduct or potential criminal conduct. Certainly in many situations, insurers are the first to notice what might be a pattern of activity that's criminal and dangerous to members of society. Arson, examples of staged auto accidents, rings that are they're involved in staging.
May I interrupt on this
you
moment?
Bet.
It looks like, if I may be
sure.
So blunt, that the insurance companies need a statutory cover in order to cooperate with law enforcement to provide information that they've gathered so that they don't get in trouble for having done so.
That's exactly right. The basic provision within the insurance code is to make insurance information not subject to disclosure. And while there are some provisions in the code that deal with the disclosure of information, those provisions are not adequate for a variety of reasons. And so, as the chair has indicated, what you see before you is a provision that encourages and allows for cooperation and exchange of information between the two parties. The essence of the bill is Section 3, and I'd be happy to, I guess, go through those sections with you, or if, as the chair has indicated, you have already had an opportunity to peruse those sections, I'll simply stop at this point.
Mr. Monroe, I've been astounded sometimes, certainly impressed by the fact that the committee members do read these things before we start and have very sharp questions when they have things that bother them about these bills.
Okay.
And other times it's very mellow, which means we can move fast if it looks good, and if there's a problem, we usually know what the problem is early on. But the essence of this is to allow that cooperation, and it means, too, that the victimized citizen will not only get their – it won't harm their capability to get insurance benefits, but it also means that if there is a law enforcement issue, that can be pursued also. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. In fact, you know, in some ways, obviously, it probably would enhance their ability to obtain insurance because, you know, an inordinate amount of fraudulent insurance activity drives all of our premiums up, and so obviously it becomes more available to certain segments.
All right. Do any members have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How will the determination be made what information is appropriate to provide because of suspected criminal behavior, and what's just a request from law enforcement because they want to start an investigation on the individual? Where's that line?
Well, you know, I think as you can see, all of the provisions here, whether it's insurers providing it or and there is a provision in here, obviously for information coming the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
They're all obviously conditioned on the fact that information won't be provided if it's privileged, if there's another privilege that exists, or in the case of, for example, an insurer asking for information from a law enforcement agency, and an exchange of information would often be necessary in order to get them both working on resolving the issue. That exchange, at least coming in that direction, is also subject to various investigatory limitations. But I think in response to your question, clearly it will depend on the kind of information asked for and an evaluation as to whether or not that information might be subject to a privilege. If it isn't, then there will be the obligation to provide that information.
I may follow up, Mr.
Sure.
Chair? Thank you. I'm trying to figure out where the line is, because I know currently with insurance companies, they give out a lot of information that I think they really shouldn't be giving out, whether it's selling it to other people to try to sell you other things, or, for instance, I remember trying to get some insurance on my car,
mm-hmm.
and I found out that somehow they got information from my health record that said that I was going to see a doctor over the last couple of months. And that concerned me because I thought, you know, one has nothing to do with the other, and why are these people talking to each other? So my concern is with immunity from providing this kind of information. To me, it makes it much easier for you to give information to anybody who asks for it, and you have no accountability as the insurance industry as to whether or not you're weighing public interest against somebody's right to privacy. So I'm still trying to figure out where that line is before you even start the cooperation process. Must something happen on your end where you see a pattern of abuse and then you would notify law enforcement? Or how do you see this happening in the real world?
Well, I'm not representing Bowman, Mr. Chairman, representing Bowman. I'm not sure I obviously can respond to the question about the exchange of information
mm-hmm.
that you encountered. I understand
mm-hmm.
that. You know, again, at least in accordance with the provisions in the proposed law, I guess it's fairly straightforward. If a law enforcement agency makes a request of, for example, looking at subsection 1 of section 3, if a law enforcement agency makes a request of an insurance agency for information, and that information is not subject to one of the many legal privileges that currently exist in the code, then the insurer would have an affirmative duty to provide that information.
Well, first of all, we have two situations. We have the situation where the insurance company is reviewing the claim and believes in the claim, has no problem with the claim, but then finds that the claim involves their own insured having been victimized by someone else, gathers this information. Law enforcement wants to come in and go after the victimizer. That's one situation, and the insurance company, unless it's confidential or privileged information, if it's requested by a law enforcement agency, can provide it. The second situation is when the insurance company is investigating a claim and thinks that the claimant himself or herself may have engaged in illegal activity, such as filing a false claim, or they committed arson in order to try to claim benefits. And then you're gathering this information, and law enforcement comes in and asks for it. Now, law enforcement has to be careful about this relationship. If they make the insurance company their agent, then the insurance company is subject to all the search and seizure standards of the government. However, if they have a freestanding relationship and then they come in and request information, the insurance company can act like any private citizen who has information and say, unless it's privileged or confidential and you're asking for it, we can provide it. So there is this fine balance that Representative Bowman's talking about. The key words would be legal privilege and confidentiality for the insurance company side. To the extent that they're dealing with privileged or confidential information, they have to hold that back unless there's a court order. On the agency side, they need to avoid improper conduct, too. They can't just share information that is privileged or confidential. They may have other information under this bill which they can share that's not subject to that restriction. Is that the kind of balance that's been built into this, Mr. Monroe?
I believe that to be correct.
Mr. Chair, is that different from current law? I mean, current law, wouldn't law enforcement now be able to go to an insurance company and request information if they're doing...
Well, that's a good question. I had assumed that was the situation, but... And certainly I would think that there's some common law concepts involved there. This would set out a statutory framework. Knowing how insurance companies operate, they get real nervous when they don't have something in black and white that they can look at. This gives them something in black and white that they can look at. At least that's my read of this.
Okay.
Other questions for Mr. Monroe? We have no one else signed up. Was there any opposition in the Senate, Mr. Monroe?
Mr. Chairman, there was no opposition in the Senate.
Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 1210? Seeing no one raising their hands or waving or doing any other sort of thing, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1210 and move into work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cinceri.
I move Senate Bill 1210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
My colleagues, you've heard Representative Cinceri's motion. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection?
I object.
Representative Bowman objects. Please call the roll on the motion to send to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Stevens?
Aye.
Representative Cinceri?
Yes.
Chair Bennett?
Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 1210 is sent to the floor with a due pass. Representative Cinceri, do you want to be the carrier? All right. Representative Cinceri will be the carrier. This closes the work session on Senate Bill 1210. We will move into this work session on Senate Bill 848, and I'll ask counsel to summarize where we are.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has before the Dash 5 amendments, which replace the original content of the bill. What those do is to provide that a person commits the offense of unlawful directing of light from a laser pointer if a person knowingly, and that incorporates intentionally as well, directs light from a laser pointer at another person without the consent of that other person, and then the other person is either a peace officer, which means a police officer, sheriff, or as that is otherwise defined in the criminal code, or a uniformed private security officer. This is defined as a Class A misdemeanor as it was in the original bill, and the definition of laser pointer has not been changed from the original bill.
And these Dash 5 amendments that we have here reflect continued refinement based on the discussions that we've had so far.
Correct.
You mentioned that we may need to make some legislative history on this.
I think so, Mr. Chairman. I can see one issue in trial courts and at the appellate court being what the word knowingly applies to in this Dash 5 amendment. Clearly, the knowing state of mind does apply to the act of directing light from a laser pointer at another person. I don't think that's a question. If the person is not doing that knowingly or intentionally, then no offense would be committed. But there are two other areas of the bill that I think I would welcome some legislative history on,
fact,
whether or not knowingly applies.
Knowingly applies to knowing that you've got this laser thing in your hand, the laser pointer, and you know you're pointing at somebody else, and you know you don't have their consent. Now, I'll pause there and say, you may not know that the person is a peace officer acting in the course of official duty. You know, you're not going to walk up and say, "Officer, I'm about to point this laser pointer on you. I see you're in uniform. Are you on duty? Or I see you're out of uniform." All right. In other words, the person, it's just sort of strict liability as the fact you just aimed it at a peace officer. As to uniform private security officer, well, we'd have to prove that the person's in uniform. I don't think we need to prove that the perpetrator knew that this uniformed person was a private security officer, just he was a uniformed person. The consent part needs to be strict liability, that is, unless you can establish that as a defense that you did have consent, you're mutually engaging in this, then they weren't consenting to it.
I have a question,
Mr.
Chair. What if I point my laser pointer inside a police car, but I'm not aiming at the cop himself? So I'm just like pointing it at the dashboard of the police car. Under this law, I could not be prosecuted because as long as I'm not pointing it at him, I'm not committing a crime.
Well, I guess that would be the testimony the defendant would present. The jury would be able to hear that testimony and determine whether or not the person was pointing and missing
or whether the person was pointing and really was deliberately pointing at, not trying to point at the person. And they'll look at the totality of the circumstances. I dare say if someone points a laser light at the inside of a patrol car with an officer inside, that 9 times out of 10 the jury is going to infer from that that they were pointing at the officer, or if, frankly, in terms of what the jury's common sense interpretation would be, that they were stupid enough to have pointed it into the patrol car, and the jury probably won't be forgiving, although that won't be the legal standard. I'm just talking common sense here, how juries look at evidence that's presented, and it's going to be what I call the duh factor. Well, duh, you pointed inside the patrol car. You want to tell us that you weren't pointing it at the driver or you missed him deliberately? That's like someone saying they fired a shot at somebody and, oh, I deliberately missed. I intended to shoot 6 inches away from his chest. Sure, tell it to the jury. But so I want to make that clear that if that's a fact issue for the jury. Mr. Horton, did you want to comment on these points?
I think really one of the main issues then, as you discussed, Mr. Chairman, is the consent issue, whether that has to be knowing. And I draw an analogy with a stolen car situation. Rather than having to prove, the prosecutor having to prove that the defendant knew he didn't have consent, really what happens in the case is the victim comes up and says, no, this person did not have consent to take my car. And I think that that is probably an appropriate analogy for this as well. It's very difficult to prove that a defendant knew something about what another person was thinking. And so, as you said, Mr. Chairman, that would have to be strict liability, and the way that would be established, and the only way it could be established, is for the victim to say, no, the person didn't have consent. That's what I understood you to say.
Right. On the other hand, if they go to the laser tag game and they both say, let's play laser tag, we know what's going on.
How big is this problem?
Well, we had a lot of testimony about this, actually, when the bill first came up. I don't know if you were in the room. We had a lot of testimony from law enforcement about the increasing activity and that law enforcement's trained to respond. This is why this bill is limited in the scope of application, that because of their training, if a laser pointer is aimed anywhere near them, they have to move into a defensive situation and be prepared to defend themselves and possibly use deadly force. And it can be a very life-threatening situation based on their training, and that it is not a joke. That was the testimony that we had, and it's pretty dramatic about situations that have arisen where people think it's funny to put laser pointers on peace officers. And they want to get the word out, don't do it, it's a crime.
Chair?
Yes.
I move the Dash 5 amendments in the Senate Bill 848.
All right. Representative Gianella moves adoption of the Dash 5 amendments. Discussion. Representative Hansen.
I'm concerned on the uniform private security officer piece. Couple questions there. One, unarmed, if we're doing this because of the reaction of deadly force, why would we extend that to unarmed uniformed private security officers?
And Mike, do you want me to respond?
Go ahead. And then the other question is, do we have a definition of uniformed? Would that also cover a security crew at a rock concert that's wearing slacks and a T-shirt?
I'll leave that up to a jury in a given case. We do have security officer defined, and we do have standards now for certification of security officers. As to whether they're armed or unarmed, deadly force wasn't the only reason. It was also the reaction of the individual. There was some interest in making this apply to any citizen for the lower level, but we've narrowed this, and the narrowing was done because the idea is people are playing around with people who are supposed to be providing security and toying with them with these laser lights. We didn't want to get into whether or not gang members are aiming this at each other or whether or not kids are aiming it at each other. This is basically limited to peace officers, but uniformed private security officers also, their uniforms sometimes look like police officers' uniforms. And they are in situations where we tried to focus on people who are in situations where it's their job to protect others and where they may feel threatened by the laser pointer being aimed at them and stop there. Some states have gone further. The deadly force was a factor as to the peace officer, but wasn't the only factor. This is a refinement of the one, different versions, one of which said any citizen pointing at another citizen, and, you know, it's been narrowed.
But if our whole rationalization is the deadly force, if if we're going on to that police officers and the fact that they're wearing a uniform can feel uncomfortable if the red dot appears on their chest, that's another set of broadening, but it goes beyond reacting to the deadly force.
Well, that was just deadly force is one factor, but not the only factor. It's also the fear that's caused by the individual who's placed in this position. Frankly, I personally think that anybody who points a laser light at anybody else without just cause ought to be held liable somehow, but we've narrowed this down to try to make it a more palatable bill for all concerned.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do appreciate the efforts to narrow the bill down, and I think it's appropriate to include the uniformed private security officer in his shoes and be standing outside a door somewhere and all of a sudden see a light pointed at my chest and think somebody was aiming a firearm at me and about ready to fire. Laser sights are becoming more common, and I think it's appropriate to include that.
I might add that we had other testimony about potential damage to eyes if the laser pointer strikes someone in the eye. And we had testimony about a bus driver who had a laser pointer flashed in his eyes, but we left out the broader pieces for now. At least the discussion that was developing was, let's just do this, let's not go too far. We've heard issues about road rage and people flashing laser lights at each other and people flashing in rearview mirrors and all this stuff. And this is the cautious approach based on what we've heard so far, at least. Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do remember all the testimony we had, and it was pretty compelling testimony. The only thing I want to say for the record, though, is I think that it's important that BPSST create some training around this issue, because no matter how many laws we put on the book, the reaction of law enforcement on the street is not going to change because we passed this law. If somebody is aiming a light at you and you think it's a gun, you're going to defend yourself. And so unless there's some additional training on the other side, and I don't know what kind of training that would be, because when they flash the lights, I couldn't tell a difference, from my untrained eye between the laser pointer and a firearm. And so I think it's really important that we continue to encourage that some additional law enforcement training is done, because I don't think any of us want to be reading in the paper about some kid being killed because they were out playing over an overpass and got shot because somebody thought they had a gun. And so I will support this bill today, but I do want to come and do some follow-up on what kind of training is taking place.
Colleagues, we have the Dash 5 amendments in front of us. Representative Gianella has moved their adoption. Is there further discussion on that motion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the Dash 5 amendments are adopted. President Gianella, do you move the bill to the floor of the due pass?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, colleagues, you've heard that motion. It sounds like we debated that motion also.
Yep.
Is there objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 848 with the Dash 5 amendments is sent to the floor of the due pass. Representative Gianella, do you want to carry this bill? All right, Representative Gianella will carry this bill. This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 848. I don't believe there's any other business before the committee today. Accordingly, we are adjourned. Oh, committee, we are meeting at 8 Friday because we only have session at 9. We only have an hour, so we have to meet at 8. If we haven't finished whatever we're doing,